You're listening to the Punk News Podcast for the week of May 22nd, 2013.
Hello, it's Kira again from Baltimore. This week I'm playing for you a track from Seattle's Big Eyes. This is the perfect band to listen to as we slip into summer. The trio delivers a bright, poppy sound, perfect for windows down and sing-alongs. Also of note, we recently posted an interview with front woman Kate Eldridge on the site, so I would strongly encourage you to give that a read if you haven't done so yet. So here you go, Pretend to Care by Big Eyes. Enjoy.
Welcome to the Punk News Podcast. Again, I'm Chris Marin. I'll be your host and moderator this week. I am joined by the infamous, the one and only Adam White from Niagara Falls. Welcome, Adam.
Honeymoon capital of the world.
Woo! Bone City.
Is that a fact?
That is a, well, I don't know if it's a fact, but it's on like our park benches. So you're going to argue with the park bench?
It's Niagara Falls. Of course it is.
I don't know. I know I haven't been introduced yet, but do you know what are on the park benches in my city?
Fuck off. That's Baltimore for you.
No, it says the greatest city and the city that reads. Those are what the park benches here say.
The city that reads?
The city that reads.
They're proud they've finally learned to do that. Ladies and gentlemen, Kira Wisniewski from Baltimore, Maryland.
Woo!
I don't get why they call it Charm City. There is absolutely nothing charming about Baltimore.
Oh, that's not true. It's very charming. There are many charming things about the city.
No, seriously, but I want to get back to this city that reads thing. Like, why? I mean,
well, the city that reads.
What makes you so exceptional in reading compared to the rest of us?
I mean, I don't know. That's why I think that you maybe shouldn't trust that park bench that says that you live in the honeymoon capital of the world.
I guess, but I mean, at least you could assume that that might be true. I mean, like, Baltimore is not, you know, you're not like Alexandria, Egypt. Like, you're not known for your library, are you? At least up in...
I mean, real talk, there are some beautiful, beautiful libraries here. Like, for instance, right down the street from where I live, the Peabody Library, gorgeous, so pretty.
Can we just talk about can we just talk about the Wire if we're talking about Baltimore?
So it always goes to that.
Well, best show in the history of television. What can I say?
I mean, I can't argue too much with that.
But that will yet to be seen with this Saturday's Arrested Development premiere. So with that said, I'm that's not really a segue for our first story, but what the hell? I'm not Adam White, so I can't segue like that. Here we go, kids. Up first. Randy Blythe, many of you know as the singer of Lamb of God, has been through quite the ordeal with his recent litigation involving, as many of you know, the death of one of his fans that was killed at a show in Prague. He released a statement to his fans and also to venues. It is a very long statement, so I'm not going to read the entire thing. I'll kind of give you the gist of it. Basically, what Randy talked about, his ordeal, you know, with the courts dealing with, really what amounted to be, I guess, their failure to understand, you know, the heavy metal culture, which, you know, to any outsider of, you know, our genres of music in that sense, hearing that kids like to slam around and jump on one another, I mean, yeah, it's going to sound a little odd. And basically, he was trying to explain to, you know, this foreign court that this is really just, you know, part of the excitement of the music. It's part of what they do. And from there, he goes into talking about, you know, his dealing with the young man's family. Really, actually, a very, very touching, you know, article he wrote talking about really how they didn't wish him any ill will. They didn't, you know, come after him for any damages. They didn't, you know, give him bad looks in court. That he actually mentions that he spoke with the mother and the uncle of the boy. Didn't go into too much detail about what they discussed, but one of the things that really kind of struck me about the story was the fact that the mother actually asked him, the mother and uncle each asked one thing of Randy. The mother asked if at some point he could play a song in honor of her son, which Randy commented that he would be doing many, many, many times. The uncle actually asked if Randy could make an effort to educate people and educate fans on, you know, trying to be safer at shows and the dangers that could be associated if they don't know kind of what they're getting into. So really, really, really interesting article. You know, it's obviously from the heart from Randy, and I think it's great that he took the time to actually, you know, put all this into perspective, because there's a lot of us are obviously curious about what's been going through his head during this ordeal. And I found it to be a good read. Adam, any thoughts on it?
It's super heartbreaking.
Yeah.
I mean, when he talks about, you know, how the family reacted to him in court, and then how the family asked him after the trial was all done if he could go meet with them privately, and just like the things that they asked of him and the way that he responded to it, like it's super touching. I mean, yeah, it kind of behooves you as a fan of live music or music of any kind to go to like randonesia.tumblr.com and look this up, because it is super compelling just to see his perspective on all of this, and the fact that out of the situation, you know, aside from maybe the people that were prosecuting, but between him and the family, that everyone had a very level head about it, a very kind of sane perspective on it, that no one was, you know, none of the family members were trying to, you know, persecute him out of some misguided reading of the way that live music works, and that was really more a function of the courts that happened. And it puts an incredible perspective on, you know, putting you inside Randy's head, having to live through this. But then it's incredibly, I think, I'm trying to say this without sounding super anti-American or anything, but it puts a very human perspective on the people who in Prague who had to deal with this. And I the only reason I say that is because I remember when this first came out, there was some comments about, oh, you know, the Europeans tend to go crazy and persecute stuff like this all the time, and that's clearly not the case when he's explaining the way that the family very maturely and, you know, with I think a lot of thought reacted to him in person. So it's super compelling. I think, you know, everyone should read it. It's an incredible kind of cap to this story. So, and the advice he gives is super good advice, you know, once you kind of get past the narrative of it. So yeah, it's important.
I agree. It is a completely heartbreaking story. I mean, from the beginning, I thought that it was so hard. I mean, as people of this community and people who go to these kind of shows, like, it is. So I actually did, I hustled merch on a metal and hardcore tour in the summer of 2006 called Sounds of the Underground. And like every day there are, you know, pretty, I guess you could say, positive aggression happening. But like in so many cases, every day something like this could have happened on that tour, like very easily. So it's so, everything he said is so valid, but at the same time, like as like sad and as cynical as it might be, I'm not sure how much of a difference it will make. Like, I think it definitely, I've not been to, you know, a whole lot of Lamb of God shows, but I think that the tenor of Lamb of God shows will change. But like, for instance, a couple weeks ago, I saw like the Hatebreed Every Time I Die tour. And I saw this girl, and this was at Ram's Head in Baltimore. But there is this girl who was crowd surfing during Every Time I Die. And they had a barricade and they had like the, you know, the space with the security guards. And she came like, she was a tiny girl, and she came like flying over the crowd. And she just like flew face down in that space between the barricade and the stage. Like the security guards didn't catch her. And like she, after a little while, got up and presumably she was fine. But it's like these kind of things just happen so quickly. Like Randy kind of articulates this in his very well written piece, but it's a scary thing. And like I don't think that it's necessarily going to change, though. And I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it's definitely a very, like, this is like, as Adam was saying, like kind of humanizing and putting a narrative on this, I think, is really important. And like really good for people to take the time to read it, because it is kind of a long read, but it's very well written. But yeah, I don't know, like, do you two think, like, going to a hardcore metal show, like, that it's going to change that much?
Unfortunately not.
I want to say that out of any of these shows that, you know, that I attend, and I'm far more on the hardcore end of things than on the metal end of things, so maybe I don't have the right perspective on this, but I get the impression from, you know, seeing people fall and get picked up that a lot of the, you know, that for the most part, you know, people are fairly aware of each other. People are fairly, you know, safe at these things. Maybe I'm not at the right shows where people aren't going completely bonkers, but
no, I would tend to agree. I think for the most part, like, I don't think every now and again you get somebody who's just a total dick and trying to hurt people, but that is like far and above like a small, small minority. I think that you're right. Like, generally people who are there at these like more aggressive music shows, that sounds so silly. Anyway, but like at more of these like heavier shows, people aren't trying to hurt anyone. If people are trying to like get things out in like a positively aggressive way, as contradicting as that sounds, like for instance, this girl who totally ate it during Every Time I Die, like I don't think anybody was trying to hurt her, you know, she just happened to be like so small that she just kind of like flew over, you know, and then the security guards didn't catch her. So it's just like a bad situation for, not that anybody has any ill intent, but it's just like injuries are bound to happen. And I don't really know how much it's going to change. It's just like, this is such an unfortunate thing that's happened. And it's so scary to me that like things like this happen, like this guy died, which is horrible and sad and all of that. But I mean, I don't remember if you guys recall when this came out, there was like some really fuzzy video that came out about this show in question, and like watching it, it was kind of like, yeah, it looks like a hardcore metal show. Like, nothing seemed out of the ordinary except that this kid, unfortunately, died at it or because of it.
Well, I mean, you've got to ask, how much is this the same perspective we have if we look at, say, a plane crash? Where we're, you know, we'd look at a plane crash and say, like, you know, oh my God, how did this happen? You know, what can we do to prevent this next time? But if you look at it statistically, most planes don't crash. And it's actually an incredibly safe form of travel. Is this the same sort of thing where, you know, it is incredibly sad that someone died at this show? And it's incredibly unfortunate when people are hurt in any way at these shows. But it's got to be by far the minority.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. I mean, not to you know, belittle this incident in any way, because of course it's sad and tragic, and but I think that that's a valid point. Like, there are literally zillions of hardcore and metal shows every week, and you know, people do get, you know, bumps and bruises, but they're not often fatal. So I think that's valid, Adam White.
Zillions.
Zillions, like at
zillions.
Least,
like zillions. At least a zillion.
At least there's like a zillion happening in Baltimore tonight.
I don't know. You guys should read it, though. By you guys, I mean like the people.
I'm prepared this week. I read it. But
I had a cousin read it to me when we were driving home from D.C. on my way here.
Close enough.
Fact.
All right. Well, moving on to a little more lighter news, and I'm sure news that Adam White is stoked about. So the Clash are going to be releasing a collective, I guess, if you will. It's going to be called the Clash Sound System. It's going to include all of their seminal studio records, remastered, three demos, some non-album singles, rarities, B-sides, DVD of all the videos, including some unseen footage that was done by Julian Temple and Don Letts, some original and newly commissioned Clash fanzines. There's an exclusive poster, some dog tags, stickers, badges, and more. They're also later going to – that's going to be out on September 10th, but you can pre-order it right now. They're also releasing a 2-CD album of 33 classic Clash songs sequenced from their Brixton Fair Deal performance in 1982. It'll be entitled Hits Back. There are also 8 bonus tracks and a set list written by Joe Strummer. No specifics on when that will be coming out. Adam, aside from the fact that this is CD and not vinyl, what are your thoughts?
You know what? I thought it was vinyl until like half an hour ago. and it has completely changed my perspective on this. And it's weird for me to say that at all, because I've been trying to like live this life where I'm not fetishizing, you know, band objects as much. And this is partly me trying to be like a mature adult with like a family and a mortgage and stuff like that. And it's partly me just trying not to have so much fucking shit in my house. So, I mean, okay. So like the Clash is like, it's unequivocally my favorite band. So seeing this initially, I was just like, you know, fuck all my financial maturity. I want this thing. But then I've been sitting here like looking at the big photograph they have of all the crap that's in there that's all kind of laid out, and I'm staring at the albums, and I'm like, okay, numerically they make sense because, you know, Sandinista was a 3-record set and London Calling was a double album. But I'm looking at them and I'm like, the scale of none of these pictures makes sense to me. And then I'm like, oh, it's CDs. Shit. So it's CDs that they made look like records. So, okay. Again, I'm not a vinyl collector per se. Like I probably own like maybe like 2 dozen actual physical vinyl records or something like that. So, you know, I'm by far the person to like, you know, get all up in arms about something being on CD and not vinyl. But if you're going to spend $300 on like a giant magical box full of crap, you would sort of expect that it would be like, you know, nice big records with like full-sized art and all that stuff. And if it was that, I don't think I'd have any problem with this. But you know what? I'm not going to buy this thing if it's CDs. I totally want to hear the stuff that's on the B-side in the demo or wherever it is records. But I'm pretty sure I'll be able to hear that stuff on like radio or some other digital service. So, yeah, I'm out. I was in, but I'm out. If this thing was vinyl, if they release a vinyl one, I'm totally down for it. But there is just, you know, if I'm going to go out and spend a whole bunch of money on just on essentially like a really super expensive fetish object, then it may as well be vinyl, because you know, I have all this music otherwise. So I don't need another copy of London Calling on CD. I have enough of them.
I like how you call this a fetish.
Yeah, you know what? So much of this vinyl stuff is fetish. The whole fucking paper and plastic model is fetish. It's, you know, if you guys wanted to really hear music, use lots of ways to hear music, and fully legal ones that are, you know, probably digital, but, you know, to most of the people's ears isn't going to sound any different. If you're going out and buying some like super collector's edition that's on like purple vinyl and you have to have that because you already have the pink variant of it, that's fetish. You're buying it because it's like a fun collectible trinket to have. You're not buying it because of any kind of like, you know, it's not about the music, man, because you have to have like 10 colors of vinyl or something like that. So I'm just calling it what it is. But I'm saying I'd totally be down for the complete, you know, $300 wallet emptying fetish here. Like, fleece me on this. I'm totally cool with it, but just make it vinyl. It feels somehow less doing it CD. And maybe this is just like how much the CD as a format has lost its mystique over the past few years. But I don't want this on CD. Maybe I'm wrong, but blah.
Adam White. All right, I have two follow-up questions specifically for... Actually, you both can answer them. But do you have the Clash dog tags? And then doesn't that have a certain allure to you?
Do I have the giant cigarette-shaped poster tube either?
Second question.
It took me a while to figure out what that was. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, any of the extra crap that they throw into this box, to me, it's like, you know, you'd be buying one of these things because you want like a nice quality copy of every Clash record on vinyl. And that's why you'd be buying it. I don't know. I mean, I'm assuming because like who? I don't know. I don't really care about Clash dog tags. It'd be the kind of thing that like me, I would take it out of the box and look at it and go, huh, I suppose these are collectible. I shouldn't touch them. And I would put them back in the box. I mean, and I'm bad about doing that. And I know that it's complete bullshit because it's not really collectible to anyone outside of the box itself. But like I have this really fantastic Briefs 7-inch box set that I have a copy of and haven't reviewed yet because I'm a horrible punk news editor. And in the box along with these 7-inches, there's like a 7-inch button and like maybe a sticker or something. And I'm like, ooh, gotta leave those in the box because those are part of that set. Like if I take that and I attach that to like the bag that I have my other pins on and it gets in the rain and rusty, then I've wrecked something. And I don't know why I have that, what mental part of me does that, because I'm never going to sell this thing. Like, I'm not in the market for that. It's probably going to get beat up just being knocked around my house. My daughter's probably going to spill juice on it at some point. But for some reason, I can't take the pin out of the box because somehow it's part of the set, which I don't know, just speaks to the complete, you know, insanity of these things. But
yeah, I don't know. You're almost the target demographic for this then. But I do have a follow-up question for Chris Moran related to this. Chris Moran, you, I am assuming, are not going to purchase this $250 CD stereo thing. Yes or no?
I will not be purchasing. You are correct.
That's what I thought. Would you do this for, say, face-to-face?
Not on CD, no.
Would you do this for any band on CD?
No. Well, unless I would do it CD if... I'll give you an example. I did it for the Nirvana the Nirvana box set, which wasn't even that good.
But that was pre the, you know, the vinyl reemergence, was it not?
That
it was
pretty, yeah.
Like digital music, really. Yeah.
And it was all like basically unreleased stuff, mind you. It was kind of crappy. Yeah, but I'm not buying anything re-released on CD. It's just, in fact, I mean, I'm not buying a CD unless it's the only way to get something now.
I'm with you. Do you guys have, like, I had when I was a young whippersnapper, when CDs were all the thing and, you know, box set things were great, my, like, prized CD box set was that Smashing Pumpkins one. Do you know what I speak of?
I have that. It comes in the one that like gives you that's all like hypnotizing or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. So that I have that. My prize CD box set that I had. Do you have anything like that? I guess you have Nirvana, Chris. What about you?
I have the Nirvana one. Not only that, I also have the heart-shaped box.
Oh.
You see, for me, and this is entirely appropriate, is I have a copy of Clash on Broadway. Like the box set, and it was when they actually released box sets and they were nice, like when they were long boxes, like three CDs tall, because they went and they re-released that thing later as just like a, you know, CD sized box set. But the big tall one has like a really nice book in it that kind of walks through each song. And really, that was probably my serious introduction to the Clash, because like I was a kid in the 90s and I listened to like Rancid and stuff like that, and then they were like, oh, if you're listening to Rancid, they just sound like the Clash. And I remember I went to some used CD store and they had Clash on Broadway there because someone sold it, and I bought it, and I listened to that whole thing through before I ever listened to like an individual Clash album. So yeah, I mean, and it's so like that was that CD, that Clash CD box set was totally like one of my major introductions to punk music. But I still have it. I don't need like it again. And I don't know. I don't know if we're right in this. I guess people should. I'm curious to see what our listeners actually think of this. And I, like, we all seem to have the same opinion here, is that like the CD seems sort of unnecessary. Like if you want it to collect, get vinyl. If you just want it to listen to, there's like 500 ways to get it digitally. So where does, you know, is the CD unnecessary? Like where does it fall in people's lives these days?
It's unnecessary.
Like, and I say this as someone that like behind me in my office right now, I have like four of these big, tall IKEA CD shelves. That I had when I was in my, when I was in university, I bought them. And when I was in university, they were full top to bottom, you know, in CDs. And, you know, part of my freaking life was reorganizing the CD. It was like a high fidelity thing, was reorganizing the CDs all the time for whatever reason popped into my head that I needed to reorganize this thing. And I had like a list.
Did you go alphabetical?
I went alphabetical, but just, you know, by shelves are kind of stupid in that, you know, you fill up your A's, well, you got to fucking bump everything down, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So
I had the same thing you're talking about, so I'm
yeah, so there. So I had this wall of CDs when I was in university. And I remember that, you know, like our one-time editor, now Alt Press editor, Scott Heisel, had the same sort of thing. And it was a big deal at the time to, like, go onto the internet, post your giant list of music that you owned, maybe post a picture of your shelf porn that you had. And, you know, and to kind of show it off that way. Well, now, you know, I'm in a basement that I'm renovating. So the shelves, I have them against a wall here. They're empty. All the CDs I have in boxes that are, you know, stored next to my furnace. And with the exception of like one or two things that in my head are super collectible and that I want to make sure don't get fucked up, I don't really feel like taking all those CDs out of those boxes next to my furnace and putting them back on the shelf.
Yeah,
I'm not really going to sell them, only because there's nowhere around here to sell them that wouldn't be a huge pain in the ass.
And you're going to be like, I paid $10 for this. I'm not taking 50 cents.
Yeah, exactly. And I totally do not have the patience to go into, like, you know, eBay 400 fucking CDs or whatever it is, right? But now I'm in this conundrum. I'm like, well, what do I do with these things? Like, I suppose I'll keep them because I paid for them. But long ago, I had digitized everything that I wanted to hear out of there, so I have it as MP3s. And recently, I'm not even listening to my fucking MP3 library. I'm listening to everything on radio, or RDIO, or however people pronounce it, right? So, I don't even know. It's like, now I have all this stuff.
I hear you. I moved in September and I have a box of CDs that I used to, even until my most recent apartment, had like on a nice little shelf. But now it's like in a banker's box in my spare room and it's just hanging out there. But okay, I know we've been talking about this a long time, but I just had an additional thought. Do you think, this is kind of a two-part question for both of you, that this would have more of appeal, not necessarily to you, but to the general populace, if it was cassettes, because that's some weird fucking fad that's
happening.
Okay, that's Chris's opinion on that. Second follow-up related to that, do you think that CDs will ever have this weird nostalgia that tapes are having to a certain niche of people right now?
Yeah, only because CDs, like, they look cool, and I think in, I don't know, 15 years, people are gonna kind of laugh at them because, you know, at the time they looked so futuristic, kind of like, you know, like a lot of like 1960s furniture. So I think there's gonna be a point where people are like, wow, this was considered like the pinnacle of their time, and you know, yada yada yada. So yeah, and you know, you can do all kinds of fun shit with CDs too. I mean, they're flat and circular. I mean, sky's the limit. So yeah, I think you will see the retroness of the CD return, along with the Zach Morris cell phone.
God, I picture like an ad that's like CDs. The sky's the limit. you know what? I honestly don't. I don't really see that happening. Only because like the CD was convenient in that it gave you, you know, a reasonably sized digital copy of music, and that's why it was sort of important. And now we have even more reasonably sized digital copies of music. I mean, like, the shitty fidelity of MP3s aside, like, that's not an issue to me. Like, you know, if you want higher quality digital files, you can get them, and disk space is cheap, so whatever. As for the tape thing, I'm convinced that the tape thing exists entirely in the realm of, like, snarky postmodern irony. Yep. That no one actually wants tapes, and none of the bands that are putting out tapes actually want tapes. And it's like everyone is in on the same joke, and we're all just kind of smirking at each other and buying each other's shitty tapes that we can go put in like a fucking box somewhere and not listen to ever because they're fucking tapes. Like, I'm totally convinced that tapes are just like a big goofy in-joke. Then at some point, you know, the bottom is just going to fall out and then we're all going to stop laughing and just, you know, take a breath and go, oh, God, what was that all about? And then there'll never be tapes anymore.
See, the thing is, all of these kids who, and I'm going to show my age here, but all these kids who, like, are into this tape fad thing didn't grow up with tapes. I grew up with tapes. They were horrible. You had to fast forward, and now you're not quite there. Fast forward. Oh, I went too far. I mean, terrible. And then, you know, you had to take a pencil and, like, wind them if they like got like messed up and reeled out. So tapes are
it's like having a like a fetish for polio. Like, wasn't it cool when we had polio? Polio was awesome. We don't have polio anymore. We need to have polio again.
So would CDs be like AIDS?
No. I mean, like, CDs had like a convenience factor to them. We're just like better than them now. We have other options that have just eclipsed them in basically all ways. But tapes, yeah, tapes sucked. And they still suck. It's just kind of like, it's funny that you can buy them. And I guess that's why we're buying them, because it's fun.
And the other thing about CDs, though, that, I mean, made it more of a natural progression towards MP3s is that you could take your CD and make it into an MP3 very easily. It was, I mean, brilliant as far as the timing of you know, bringing on new devices like the iPod and the Zune and all that. But the tape was just, I mean, fucking dead. I mean, it just stopped and there's no use for it. The CD can still find its place in the world because you have all these different formats of is it, you know, an iPod, is it this or that. The CD you can still take universally anywhere and play it.
True.
So yeah. All right, well, let's do one more story and then we'll break for a jam. Well, we'll do a two-in-one combo here. So we got some news about some festival news. First one, looks like the Night Marchers and Paint It Black have been added to the continuously growing lineup of the Fest 12. Yeah, so there's some more bands that are joining, plenty more, which I'm going to kind of break off here and just tell you guys a really weird rumor I heard about Fest 12, and I hope it's true, but yeah, haven't seen any confirmation on it yet. I'm hearing that that one of the yet-to-be-announced bands is going to be Millencolin, which if that's true, oh boy, I will be stoked.
Have they been playing much?
I don't know, but I've only seen them once, and I saw them at, it was Warped Tour 2, and they did a set of Sublime covers.
Oh.
It was in honor of Mr. Bradley Knoll.
Okay.
So.
I'm just trying to think of the timing here. I mean, coming June 9th, Punk News is sponsoring the Scene Music Festival up here in my neck of the woods, and Nikola Skarkovic, is that his name?
That sounds good to me.
That sounds good enough. I'm not looking, so I'm probably totally mangling that up. The lead singer guy, bassist from Millencolin, is playing Scene up here. So, and honestly, when I saw that pop up, it was kind of like surprising to me. It was like, oh, he's around. That's interesting. So, well, yeah, I'm kind of excited to see him. I was a big Millencolin fan back in the post-ska, like the Pennybridge Pioneers was
a
big album.
That's a damn fine record.
Yeah, I bought that album in Killington, Vermont when snowboarding. So, yeah, it's one of these Adam Snowboarder Dude records. So, I'm excited to go see them because when I was younger, you know, they were a band that I really liked. I haven't recalled that they're playing anything recently.
Well, it probably is just another one of those vicious rumors, but God, if it's true, I'd be stoked. Second part of festival news, Riot Fest, which has this ungodly lineup this year. I'm not even going to go into it because it's too amazing. You need to go look it up if you haven't heard it yet. All I'm going to say is there's three specific bands on there that are going to be amazing. And one of them was recently on a children's television show. I'm going to leave it there. Anyways, Riot Fest has announced dates in Toronto and Denver. We still don't have any confirmation on the lineups for either of those festivals. But yeah, pretty cool. And the band is Rocket from the Crypt.
I have a question about this Riot Fest announcement.
Do you have a question about Rocket from the Crypt? I'll be glad to answer it.
I don't currently, but in a moment maybe. About Riot Fest and how it's having a Toronto and Denver date, does this mean that it's going to have the same lineup? What makes it still Riot Fest?
It's the Riot Fest branding. It's the same promoters doing it. They haven't announced whether or not it's going to be the same lineup, but it's the same promoters, and it's the name thing, kind of like how they've I don't want to say kind of like Warped Tour, but similar, because that can have different lineups at different stages. It's just the same people putting it on, and they know that people know the name Riot Fest, and therefore they'll go, so they plop it in different cities.
That's a really valid question, though, Kira. I mean, what does the name, what cachet does the name of these fests hold?
It's a brand.
Right. But, you know, if I'm at Riot Fest Toronto, what makes it a Riot Fest?
Yeah, because it's kind of I get your example with Warped Tour, but I think to a certain degree, Warped Tour has a relatively consistent lineup throughout the summer, more or less. There's bands that are on for only the beginning or the end, but you know, for the most part, the vast majority of them are generally on the whole tour. But whereas with this Riot Fest situation, they have this banging lineup in Chicago. So I feel like people right now are like, oh my God, is this banging lineup going to come to Toronto and Denver too? And it just seems like a weird announcement to me to not have any bands associated with it. I'm not going to go to Riot Fest just because it's Riot Fest. I'm going to go to Riot Fest because band X, Y, and Z is playing.
Yeah, I mean, maybe they're hoping to continue the wave of enthusiasm based on that, quote, banging lineup. I'm sure they'll probably do something where, I don't know, two of the headliners from the Chicago one, we'll just say for shits and giggles, Fall Out Boy and Motorhead, are playing at one of them, and then they'll have, you know, Blink-182 and Violent Femmes at another one. That's my guess. Don't quote me on that. We don't have any confirmation on anything about this. All I care about is the fact that Rocket from the Crypt's playing it, so, and the Lillingtons too.
So are you going to Chicago?
I am on the fence about it, but I am greatly considering it. But the thing is, I'm almost certain Rocket from the Crypt will start doing other shows. I don't have any confirmation on that, just it's a gut feeling.
Adam White, since you are with child now, do you anticipate going to any of these fests? Riot, Fest.
Now, to say so would be to presume that I went to Riot Fest Toronto last year, and I didn't because I was lazy. And the lineup was fucking awesome. Like, last year was like Descendants, NoFX, Fucked Up, Hot Water Music, Less Than Jake, Andrew WK, Lawrence Arms. So the Riot Fest Toronto lineup last year was amazing, and I didn't go for whatever reason. So I don't even want to like use my daughter as an excuse for not doing things. I just want to like attribute that now to my general like fucking failure as a human being to not go to things and stop blaming the poor baby. So that's what I'm gonna do. I mean, the baby kind of like prevented me from going to Pooza this year, and I probably won't do Fest just for, you know, boring financial reasons. But I feel that my inability to get to really cool looking shows, I have to stop blaming the person who can't talk, and I'll just take the blame.
Well, okay. Adam, okay. Will you go to Toronto if Rocket from the Crypt is there?
If Rocket from the Crypt is there, I will probably go to Toronto. See, let me tell you,
that's the power cure right there. The power of Rocket from the Crypt. I will say that if just going back to what we just talked about, if Mill and Colin gets confirmed for Fest 12, I wasn't planning on going this year. That would make me go only because I wouldn't see Mill and Colin doing a lot of shows. I think they would come over and be like a one big thing, and then that's it. So I would definitely go for that, especially if they play Penny British Pioneers from start to end.
Okay, can someone, because I've been out of it, because again, babies, fill me in on this whole Fest thing. Like, what like Fest is like 6 weeks long now. Like, what's the deal?
They've got like pre-Fest shows all week long, and
it's absurd. It's absurd. People are gonna like just die of, I shouldn't say that because of what we were talking about earlier, but people are just going to be so exhausted. Like, you're already so exhausted after a weekend of Fest. Now if people are going to try to go ham 2 days earlier in Ybor City, it's absurd to me. Maybe I'm just too fucking old for this, but it just sounds so absurd to me.
Are the things that are on the extra days kind of like ancillary shows, but like Fest is still Fest? Like, how's this work?
They're related by brand, but they're not official Fest shows. They're considered pre-Fest shows. I think this is just Tony Weinbender's sick experiment to see how hard he can make people push the human body.
I mean, well, there's also that, but I interviewed Tony last year for Punk News right before Fest 11. And one of the things we talked about in that interview was just how, like, Fest was kind of pushing the limits of, just in terms of capacity, of the size of Gainesville. Like, Gainesville being Gainesville and, like, already using, like, every possible venue, like, places that aren't even venues, just, like, spaces where they bring in all their own sound and all their own guys to, like, run the sound and everything. That, like, last year's Fest 11 pretty much had Gainesville at capacity. So, like, from that conversation that I had with him last year, it's not surprising that it's expanding to another city. And I heard that they're actually trying to, I don't know if this is confirmed or not, so, you know, rumor mill, but that they were going to try to arrange some sort of, like, shuttles or, like, transportation in between Ybor and Gainesville. Because, real talk, that's not that close. Like, it's
how far is this place?
It's like 2 hours away.
It's like part of Tampa.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, it's not like a Baltimore to DC thing, you know?
It's like, yeah, it's roughly 2 hours. It's Ybor is like the Cuban district, the old Cuban cigar rolling district of Tampa. I've been there a few times. It's actually pretty cool. Yeah. So, with that said, I think it's about time we take a little break. Before we hit the break, though, I'm going to tell you about the song we are going to play now. Actually, it is coming from, and you guys are going to be shocked to hear this. This is coming from Rise Against, who, not too long ago, were just a little punk band on Fat Records. They are anticipating the release of, it's actually the anniversary of their, well, I guess we'll call it their seminal record, Revolutions Per Minute. This is the 10th anniversary of it. Fat Records is putting it out, and it is going to have not only the entire record before, but it's going to have actually demos of all those tracks too. And that record, for any guys who haven't really listened to Rise Against, which is probably none of you, you've all heard Rise Against 1,000 times, this was kind of the record I would say that kind of really set it off for them. It's the one that that got a lot of attention for them, one of my favorite records, and it's just I'd say a classic melodic hardcore record, if that's what you want to call it. So anyways, I'm going to actually play you right now one of the demos from that record. Again, this is actually my favorite Rise Against song. It's called Heaven Knows, and this is the demo version of it, so check it out.
I'm never coming down.
back to the Punk News Podcast. Again, Chris Moran here with Kira Wisniewski and Adam White. And actually, we're gonna go ahead and read you a surprise letter from the old unopened mailbox. We actually just realized that after some time, no one had been checking our podcast at punknews.org mailbox. But don't worry, we're checking it now. And we're actually looking to do next week an all-email podcast where we'll be reading all kinds of fun stuff you guys have sent us. Should be a good time. Right now, I'm going to actually read you a letter we just got yesterday. And this is coming from Bobby Loesch. It's a pretty long email. I'm not going to read the entire thing. I'll kind of read you some parts of it. But Bobby makes some good points. So here we go. Hey guys, I was writing to let you know that after not missing a single Punk News podcast since its inception, seriously not one, I think I'm done for a while. I don't want this email to come off crazy or angry or anything, but I'd like to condense my beef to one issue. And then this is all in bold. You guys cover niche music, yet it blows me away how unfamiliar you are with most of said music. Big bands like Weezer, Alkaline Trio, Blink-182, AFI, and Foo Fighters are immediately dismissed, which I kind of get. You have to cover them, but you might not like them. But then you have smaller, fantastic bands like Elway and Banner Pilot, and you guys don't listen to them either. It colossally bums me out. The reason I got into the podcast was to listen to good writers talk about music that we all connected with, stuff like Menzingers, Gaslight Anthem, Lawrence Arms, and even old school stuff like The Clash. I like you guys. I think you have great opinions, and know that you can't hear every band in the world, but for people on the podcast to not even know who Banner Pilot is, like, what site are they writing for? Their last two records have finished in your top 10 or top 5 of year end. And I'm going to skip through just a little bit because, like I said, this is a long thing. I know calling something unpunk is about as stupid as any argument, so I'd like to use the word catty. That's what this podcast has become. It's just catty pot shots at, again, niche music. It's not discussions. It's this week we are talking about Band X's video. I didn't watch Band X's video. I know you could say, well, then don't listen, but that's so damn dismissive. I want to listen. I want to listen to like-minded people talking about a genre we all love. But isn't that the point? But what's it devolved to? It's like listening to a sports podcast for guys who don't watch the games but have sweeping opinions about each team. In summation, sorry for ranting. Best of luck in the future, and please let me know if this ever becomes a discussion. Take care, Bobby. P.S. And for the love of Graffin, I love that. Please tell Chris Moran, yours truly, to stop name-dropping and eating food and start paying attention when people are talking. Well, thank you, Bobby. I actually think you have made some very valid points, and I think... And Kira and Adam, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this episode we've actually not taken catty pot shots at things. We've except for Adam and I's disdain for cassettes, and we have actually proactively discussed music.
Yeah,
we're great. What's wrong with us?
No, I think that he makes so many valid points, and I feel like I'm like, oh, he's calling us out, but he's right. But I mean, to reveal a little bit behind the curtain, if you will. This podcast is probably one of the least unorganized things about Punk News, and just like real talk. And the fact that each week it's like a little haphazard, being like, who's on the podcast this week? And then like an hour before we do the podcast, it's like, here's what we're going to talk about. So, I mean, you know, no tea, no shade. I love the podcast. I love Punk News. It's a real fun thing to be a part of, but I think, not that it's an excuse, but it is maybe something that is like one of the most unorganized things that we do. And I do think because of that, all of Bobby's criticism is pretty fair in terms of like us not always being so prepared, not always watching all the videos that we talk about. Although I will say, I think we've done an all right job tonight. So, you know. Thanks, guys.
Which is only because we're running scared right now.
So scared of Bobby.
The letter was entirely valid, and it's a testament to our kind of like crappy prep for these things that, you know, he's right. We probably shouldn't. You know, what we tend to do is we tend to look at like the comment counts on the articles on Punk News and decide what we're going to talk about based on that. And that's probably not the best metric to use, particularly when it is something like the Elway story from last week, where it was, you know, there wasn't really a lot to discuss about it aside from the fact that, you know, they announced a track listing to a record. And despite the fact that it got some comments, if we didn't have anything to say about it, then we probably didn't need to talk about it. Now, I'm going to take full credit for boning that one because I couldn't even remember who fucking Banner Pilot was during that conversation. So, yeah, oops. But he's right. We probably should try to avoid, you know, discussing things that aren't going to foster interesting discussion, which, you know, is a completely valid thing, and we should probably try to get better at that. You know, I'm not saying necessarily that we're going to find this wellspring of prep time where we can do this, but, you know, it's valid, and I guess we're going to try to do better. So you're not listening anymore, Bobby, so I don't know why I'm even talking to you, but sorry.
We miss you.
I just wrote him an email in this very moment responding to his email saying, like, we're reading your letter right now. It's me, Adam, and Chris.
And I'm eating peanuts.
Dick.
No, I want to make one point to Mr. Bobby. I think even your criticism of me is pretty accurate. I would say I'm probably the surliest on here sometimes, where I just dismiss a lot of things just because I'm, dare I say, jaded. But keep one thing I ask you, Robert, to keep in mind is, unfortunately, some of us have been doing this for so goddamn long, and I mean not just Punk News, but, you know, some of us have been promoters, some of us have been, you know, worked for labels, some of us have done a lot of different things, and unfortunately, I know I can speak for a few of the writers or people on our staff, is that we've got a lot of our friends over the years have become people in bands, and we don't, at least I don't mean to name drop or whatever it is, but, you know, you think of somebody as, like, you know, somebody you may have known for years that's your friend, and you bring that up, and later on in retrospect, it's like, wow, I sound like a dick there. So I will try to keep that in check, but just know that, you know, most of us are well beyond being bright-eyed 20-year-olds who are trying to look cool. We're just talking about normal stuff that goes on.
Yeah.
It's like some of us need to be brought out back to the barn and shot.
Yeah.
So, like Chris mentioned a few moments ago, Nariman, our sound guy, is shuffling through all the emails that you may have sent us to podcast@punknews.org in the past, oh, I don't know, since Rich left us, because Rich was the one who was monitoring that account. So next week, all email episode. So get in those burning questions now at podcast@punknews.org. We promise that somebody's reading them now and that we'll, you know, maybe read your letter on the air next week and talk about it.
Woot woot.
Yeah, get real excited. It's going to be great.
Get pumped. All right, well, I think that's going to wrap it up. So we want to thank you guys for listening, and thank, you know, Nariman when he edits this damn thing, and thank Scotty at Death to False Hope for all of our fun theme music. Thank the bands that contributed, and we're going to, I guess, hopefully take you out with another jam here. This is part of our unorganization. We may have a song, we may not. Stick around, you never know. See you next week.
Howdy, Punk News. Bloomington, Indiana hillbilly Greg Simpson, a.k.a. Greg Orb here. I'm the head of the indie rock department here at Punk News, a position I just made up and claimed. I'm here to tell you punks about a great unpunk band, the veterans of the scene, The National. Birthed from Cincinnati College jam sessions and an old band named after vocalist Matt Berninger's mom, the group, The National, came together fully in Brooklyn in 1999, and has released a string of increasingly critically acclaimed albums and EPs. Trouble Will Find Me, their sixth full-length, which was released on Tuesday, May 21st, finds the band less tightly wound in the rhythm department, even more chill, but somehow building to even more anthemic choruses. A perfect example of this is Graceless, a song that could be a ballad if drummer Brian Devendorf wasn't so obsessed with Joy Division and their drum machine yet human patterned beats. He helped propel the song to its apex, with Berninger crooning in his now trademark baritone, also recalling Joy Division's departed Ian Curtis. They debuted this track on the Colbert Report on Wednesday night, and if you haven't heard it, here it is, The National with Graceless.
hear your voice. Just let me listen, restless. I figured out how to be faithless, but it would be a shame to waste.
Save us, grace.